Well, hello and welcome to the Mariners Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. Now, in this episode, we're going to start a new book. This one's called The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss. And amongst anybody who sails, amongst anybody who's read this kind of books over any kind of period of time, Captain Voss comes up again and again and again. Now, his voyages occurred nearly 120 years ago, but I hope that if you've been listening to the Mariners Library for a little while, you'll realise that that time difference makes no difference whatsoever. To the sea, it makes no difference. To the physics of the boat, it makes no difference. And to the human experience of being out on the waters of the world, it makes no difference whatsoever. So Captain Voss's story is still as pertinent and as informative and unbelievable today as it was in its time. So I'm going to read you a few details at the beginning of the book. The feedback I've been getting from people is that you like to know what's in the front covers of the book and the introductions and the prefaces, because it adds up to the story and illuminates further what's happening therein. So we'll read the inside of the jacket first, and then you can decide if this is something that you'd like to listen to. This first from Motorboat Magazine in 1955. The name of Captain J.C. Voss will be remembered and esteemed so long as men sail the seas, for two associated reasons. He achieved the astounding feat of sailing round the world in a decked-in canoe, drawing only 2 feet of water, and he was the great exponent of the use of a sea anchor with small craft. Venturesome voyages should be included in every sea library, even if it is only a modest single shelf. Apart from its value as a classic on ocean voyaging, Voss's book makes most entertaining reading. And then this from the Daily Record. This hardened and idiosyncratic skipper took the art of small boat sailing a great leap forward. No lad would become a worse man for reading this triumphant true story of what man can do. Let's have a look also at some of the prefaces and the write-ups at the beginning of this so we can get an understanding of Captain Voss. This, a biographical note. Little is known of Voss's life except what he tells us in this book. The best estimate I can make for his date of birth is 1854. But where was he born? Western Martyr says Newfoundland. Stone and Vincent believed it to be Nova Scotia. Luxton, of Vancouver Sunday Province, March 1932, says Sweden. He is a veritable Homer. Until recently, it was thought that John Claus Voss disappeared at sea shortly after the Sea Queen voyage. At least he put out to sea, and his Yokohama friends heard no more of him. But there now seems little doubt he was still alive 10 years later, earning a precarious living, driving a jitney at Tracy, a small town near San Francisco. He died there on the 2nd of February, 1922, aged, well, if my figures are right, about 68, though the coroner put him down as only in his early 50s. Here now the introduction by the book's compiler, Richard Hughes. The characters of great seamen and their feats have outlines which are definite. The most forgetful student could not confuse Voss with Slocum or Fred Rebel with Uffa Fox. Moreover, these outlines have such force that they give also a living shape to the ensuing narrative if one is written. Essentially, each such book is a picture of a remarkable man. The present book is certainly such a picture. The voyages described in it are three in number. The first is a treasure hunt on Cocos Island with a 10-ton sloop, Zora. The second is Tillicum's famous voyage round the world. The third is Sea Queen's meeting with a cyclone off the coast of Japan. The first man in the history of man to circumnavigate the world alone was a Yankee, Captain Joshua Slocum. He did it in the 36-foot sloop Spray, which he found a centenarian derelict in a New England orchard and rebuilt from keel to truck with his own hands. In the spring of 1895, he crossed the North Atlantic in her from west to east, meaning to pass through the Mediterranean. But after a warning of Barbary pirates given him at Gibraltar, he turned back and steered for the Horn instead. He battled his way through the Straits of Magellan, crossed the South Pacific and Indian Oceans, rounded the Cape of Good Hope, recrossed the South Atlantic, and at last tied up again to his old mooring post more than 3 years later after a voyage of over 46,000 miles. His book, Sailing Alone Around the World, has recently been reprinted and is the first classic of its kind. Like most performances of genius, it is difficult to assign a precise reason for the undertaking as to explain away its success. I doubt if Slocum himself knew clearly why he set out. A past master of the age of sail, the advent of steam had left him at a loose end, and that is about all one can say. Once done, however, it was natural that the voyage should rouse emulation. In 1901, Captain J.C. Voss, a Canadian skipper, and Norman Luxton, a Canadian journalist, connived together to go one better than Slocum. Voss was not to sail single-handed, but the craft chosen for the voyage was to be something very much smaller even than the sloop Spray. Slocum had probably picked on Spray as being the largest type of vessel whose gear could conveniently be handled by one man's strength. But it had been Slocum's own dictum that size has little to do with safety at sea, even in the worst weather. And this principle Voss was to make even more peculiarly his own. Author's note. Theoretically, the smallest craft has even certain advantages. Ceteris paribus, all things being equal, it is stronger ton for ton, and so for a given strength, more buoyant. Likewise, it is stronger per square foot of wetted surface. But the dogma, all the same, requires qualification. In such undertakings, the endurance of the crew is usually more vulnerable than that of the vessel. The smaller the craft, the greater the hardship, and so the greater the risk. Tillicum, with only 3.5-foot headroom in the cabin, could never have been so comfortable as Spray. Luxton abandoned the voyage at Fiji, and one loses count of Voss's later companions, one after another laid low by seasickness. One of the most astonishing features of Revel's lone voyage in 1932, from Australia to California, 9,000 miles in an 18-foot boat with no shelter but a canvas hood, was the hardship he must have been able to stand without loss of efficiency. The absolute limit is reached, of course, when the vessel becomes too small to carry the required stores or victuals. Introduction continued. Tillicum's hull was a dugout canoe of red cedar, brought from a Vancouver Island Indian. Even when decked over and provided with a keel and fully loaded, she drew barely 2 feet of water. Her tonnage was about a quarter that of Spray, but she too sailed round the world. It is easy to argue that Captain Voss's voyage was not so great an achievement as Captain Slocum's. First, the thing had already been done. Second, throughout its whole length he was never single-handed, except once when his companion of the moment had been swept overboard and drowned. Third, he never faced the damned regions of the Horn. There, westward bound, Slocum is still unrivalled, even today. Voss sailed west from the Pacific coast of Canada and ended his voyage in England after touching at Pernambuco, where the circumnavigation of the globe was completed. It is more profitable, however, to assess Voss's achievement in its own right, without comparisons. Voss made a considerable advance in the science of small craft sailing. Like Slocum, in a long life at sea, he had made the behaviour of winds and waves his intimate study. From the conclusions at which he arrived, he had developed that technique of the drogue, or sea anchor, with which his name has since been associated. A buoyant hull, argued Voss, at rest on the surface, rises over the worst waves, but its passage at any speed through the water creates forces of suction which tend to defeat this buoyancy and to topple breaking seas inboard. It is not enough to take in all sail. A storm will drive a boat too fast to be safe even when she is under bare poles. It is only when towing something designed to act as a brake that her speed can be kept within safe limits. Streamed from the bows, the drogue keeps her lying too, head to wind. From the stern, it lets her run, or rather crawl, before seas which otherwise would swamp her. Except by his consummate development of this technique, Tillicum could never have survived what she did survive, and though experience has shown it is far from foolproof, many sailors since have owed their lives to Voss's teaching. Voss's reputation for seamanship does not rest entirely on Tillicum's famous voyage. Chance, in 1912, put him in the most appalling predicament which a small craft sailor could have to face. But it must have been more than chance which brought him and his companions through it alive. They had set out from Japan in the Sea Queen, a little yawl yacht 19 feet on the waterline, and they ran into a really shocking typhoon. Its mere fringes, 200 miles away, lifted the roof off Yokohama Station and drove ashore a large steamer, and the little Sea Queen went slap through the middle of it. Her bare mast was broken by the wind between the deck and the hounds. The seas rolled her bottom upwards. Voss himself washed out of the cockpit, straddled her keel till she decided to complete the circle and right herself. The rest of the crew, shut in the cabin, were as helpless as men in a barrel. It is hard enough to believe that Sea Queen could have been kept afloat in such weather. It almost passes belief that after it Voss could have sailed her home. Yet there is eyewitness evidence. Weston Martyr, a seaman and nautical writer whose reputation is of course beyond question, sitting at the time on the veranda of the Yokohama Yacht Club, saw her limping in between the breakwaters. He wrote, "It did not take me long to commandeer a dinghy and get myself alongside that wreck. And I wish to make it clear that she was a wreck. She was so battered and bruised that she looked as if she had been rolled down the shaft of a very deep coal mine, and the appearance of her crew confirmed this impression. I hardly recognized Vincent, and as for Stone, he was so covered with cuts and sores that he might have been taken for an overripe Stilton. I observed the following facts myself. A. The Sea Queen's mainmast was broken in two places and her mizzen in three places. The rudder was torn in half. On one of the deck beams in the cabin, there was a perfect impression of a leg of the ship's embossed and cast iron stove. Putting all else aside, the imprint of that stove on the deck beam is evidence enough for me." Evidence, that is to say, that the Sea Queen had been turned bottom upwards, for this was the same as if you found scars left by your kitchen range on the kitchen ceiling. At this point, the reader's attention may be replaced by disgust. Why should he be asked to interest himself in men who for no good reason deliberately undertake risks so nasty and brutish? Harley Street terms for those who punish their bodies in such ways, and those who court fame by odd exploits, trip easily off the modern tongue. Then let me try to explain why I think it is a good thing that men such as Slocum and Voss should have lived. I have already said what Voss's teaching has done for the safe handling of small craft at sea. His teaching could never have been so effective had it not been demonstrated by such outstanding practice. But I would rather defend the case on wider grounds. It should not be assumed that there is necessarily anything foolhardy about such voyages. Foolhardiness is admittedly uninteresting, except to boys and fools. Rather, these voyages constitute a match between measured skill and measured danger. If what such adepts do seem foolhardy, remember that the adept can bank on a skill beyond common understanding and almost beyond belief. Skill of the first order comes not only from study and practice, but is inborn. Indeed, one must concede to such men the gift of physical genius in their control of the vast forces of wind and water with the instrument of a small boat. I use the word genius deliberately, for here is something as far beyond average skill as Yehudi Menuhin's handling of the violin or Cezanne's of a paintbrush. When I speak of the small sailing craft as an instrument and then liken the hand on the tiller to the violinist's hand on the bow, my choice of words is again deliberate. The apparent simplicity of construction of sailing boat and violin are both deceptive when you compare them, for example, with metal machinery. Man has been making and improving machines of wood and fibre for millennia. Metal machinery is still in its clumsy infancy. The simplicity of the sailing craft and the violin is the simplicity of perfection. Both are machines, but machines so consummate that they can respond to the handling of the artist rather than the mechanic. That is what I mean by the term instrument. Again, such achievements as this book records are not only valuable in themselves, but for the encouragement and instruction they offer to lesser fry. Sailing is not only a sport for the gifted few, provided always that ambition does not outrun ability. I remarked that it is a matching of measured skill with measured danger. If the skill and the danger are reasonably balanced, their degree makes little odds. It is a good thing that as many men and women as possible should practice to sail. In every lifetime there will be emergencies to be faced, however little we court them. The way to face emergencies is best learned by habit, and there is no better way of training this habit than by small craft sailing, which is, in a little way, in a constant condition of emergency. Why is it that beneath the patronage and ridicule which the landsman feels for the simple mariner, there has always lain, if the landsman is honest enough to confess it, a bedrock feeling of respect? The best blood sports are those where the only life in jeopardy is the sportsman's. Rock climbing is one of them, but perhaps too lethal an example, as addicts seldom live beyond middle age. Small craft voyaging is another, and small craft voyaging generally allows at least an extra decade or so of life. Even Slocum was lost at sea in the end. After a lifetime at sea, surely it is not extraordinary to die there. "I wonder you dare to go to bed," said the mariner to the landsman, "when so many of your relations have died there." Richard Hughes. Well, if you have a single drop of salt water in your veins, I think, like me, you're going to be pretty excited to hear more of the adventures of Captain Voss, and those will be starting in the very next episode of The Mariner's Library. So until then, if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month, you can help keep these stories and these incredible characters where they should be, uppermost in sailors' minds. But until then, I hope that wherever you are and whatever you're doing, you are safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next episode of The Mariner's Library. Cheers.